everybody. My name is Mickey Cook. I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be sober. I'm an ADD adult, so I got to get rid of all the toys. Thank you, Damien, for asking me to come out. It's an honor and a privilege to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous, and you hear that all the time from the speaker, but I want to tip from speakers when they come here how glad they are to be here, you know, how it's an honor and privilege, and they all say that, but I want to know coming from me it's genuine. I mean it. I'm sincere. You know. But it really is. You know, what a great opportunity, what a great gift, as I think about it, that Damien called me and he said, Mickey, would you come out and do the 12th step in a public forum? Would you come out and try to share your experience with a group of people, and maybe I can touch somebody so you won't have to get loaded on the way home. Maybe I can tell you something that'll just help you somewhere down the road. And if that happens tonight, I am way overpaid. My job is done. The sad part is I came down here early today. All of my grandchildren live in San Diego. Of the eight that I have, seven of them live in San Diego. So I let them love me up. And I was trying to explain to my son what happens at a speaker meeting. He says, you know, what do you do, Dad? You know, I've been sober a little while. And I said, let's go down and talk to him. And he said, man, I bet you help a lot of people. And I said, well, not necessarily, Adam, because I really believe it's like rubbing Neutrogena on the lepers at a leper colony. Because if you go there and you rub Neutrogena on, they feel better. Clearly they feel better. But when they get up, if they don't do something about their disease, they're still going to die. So my hope is tonight that I can say something that'll fill your sails up for tonight, you know, and that in the morning you'll do something to ensure your own sobriety. You know, because if you don't, I've heard it said, and it's my truth, my alcoholism demands treatment. It demands treatment. You know, it either demands treatment by the things that you bring to me, or it demands treatment by the drug alcohol. You know, and I choose to treat my problem, this, with Alcoholics Anonymous. Peg Martin says, I found the problem, and I have a firm grip on it. You know, that's just so true. You know, I went to a bookstore. My favorite meeting of the week is, I'm from Downey, California. I should give you my sobriety. My sobriety date is February 25th, 1996. My sponsor is Tom Bouchard. And my whole group is the Downey Real AA. It's held on Friday night. It's a participation meeting, probably about 200 people, but a good, strong nucleus of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's not my favorite meeting. My favorite meeting is Saturday morning because everybody gets all shiny because there's 200 people, and it's Friday night, and they're off of work, and all the girls got their makeup in order, and the guys got their best iron T-shirt on, you know. But Saturday morning, they've all stayed up too late. They haven't had any breakfast. They're a little sleep-deprived. And it gets real on Saturday morning. I've seen more people cry in that meeting than any meeting I've ever been to. And this morning, we were doing more about alcoholism, which is out of Chapter 3 in our big book. And I had to read it a couple of times because I have no memory. They warned me that if I smoked pot, that it would affect my memory. But I think they told me that. I don't remember. You know, and I'm an alcoholic. I respect the traditions, and I just want you to know that I smoked pot every day for 15 years just to prove it wasn't habit forming. But it says on page 32, it says, though we have no way of proving it, many of us could have stopped drinking long before we developed the problem. The reason they don't have any proof of it is because of what alcoholism does for an alcoholic, what it does for an alcoholic of my type. It creates that sense of, Big Book talks about unless you can experience the ease and comfort brought on by a couple of drinks. I get that ease and comfort brought on by a couple of drinks. I understand that to my core. And the problem is, if you take alcohol away from me, it doesn't get good. My life doesn't get good. I get crazy. I got about a two-day window when I start to grind myself into the ground. I'll tell you what happened to me today on the way down. I live in Downey. It's about, I don't know. Well, today was a 3.5-hour drive. Normally it's about an hour and 40 minutes or 2 hours, depending on the flashing red lights behind me. But before I came down here, in case I hit traffic, I stopped at my favorite cigar store, and I'd roll my windows down and, you know, turn on a little Led Zeppelin, and I'm doing 10 miles an hour with my windows open, you know. And I'm just smoking a cigar. I don't care how long it takes. As long as this cigar holds out, we're good, you know. But when I pulled into this parking lot, there's a Ralph's there, and I saw some guy that had just sat down and leaned up against the building. And he's probably about 40 years old and looked about 60. And he looked like he spent a little time outside. And as I drove up, he was picking up a bottle of gold tequila. How do I know it's gold tequila? Because I can recognize most brands from about 300 yards. But he took this bottle of gold tequila, and he took a couple of big pulls on it, and set it back down. And so I went into the cigar store, got my cigar, and on the way out, I had to take another look. And when I looked, he was taking another good pull off the bottle of tequila, and he stuck it between his legs, and he picked up a piece of chicken. He started to eat this piece of chicken. And I know that that morning, everything's right with that guy. He has found a solution to his alcoholism. He knows that that works for him. He's had about four good pulls of tequila, and he's got lunch. That's a good day, you know. Really. I mean, if you're an alcoholic, you get that kind of freedom. You know, I get it. I get how he's feeling. But I'm so grateful. I love Alcoholics Anonymous with everything in me because you have taught me that I no longer suffer from the delusion that that's a good idea. I don't have to live in a treehouse or on the roof of a school or in the backseat of a car. I don't have to go to jail anymore. I don't have to terrorize my children or break my mother's heart anymore. Anymore. And it's all because of you. It is really because of you. And I know, and if you're new and you're sitting there and you're saying, well, not me particularly, but yeah, you. Yeah, you. I saw a guy, and I won't single him out, but I saw a guy during the break staring intently at his cell phone. And I know there was nothing going on in his cell phone, but he couldn't find his sign that said, stay the hell away from me. Because that's what happens when we're new. We're saying, love me, love me, love me, love me, but please stay away. That's what's going on. You know, I also say, when you got here, a very friendly group, had a lot of people give me some good advice, you know, have a good time, we're glad to see you, thank you for coming out. Gee, you must really know something. I deflected that right away. I said, no, I'm not one of those speakers, don't know anything. A lot of good advice. But the single best piece of information I got when I got here was from this guy right here. He walked up to me after I'd met about 25 of you and said, your fly is down. I mean, when were you going to tell me? You know, so I thank you. I told him he's my best friend for the day. You know, so I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I got a little sidetracked in my head. I'm a quantity thinker. I'm not a quality thinker. I'm just a quantity thinker. I think really fast. It's going through really fast. And I'm just trying to pick pieces out and make sense for you. It goes really fast. I got sidetracked and I thought about, I was in Rockaway Beach, Oregon last weekend. Great conference. Great, great conference. And nice people. And on Saturday afternoon, my host took me to the Tillamook Cheese Factory. You've seen Tillamook in the market. It's a very cool place. They have an ice cream stand, which fluffy people really like, you know. But it was nice to go down there. And on the way back, I said, wow, look, a hawk. And he said, no, city boy, that's not a hawk. That would be the world's biggest hawk. That's an eagle. So he pulled over, and I got to watch this eagle fish for about 10 minutes. It never actually caught anything. He was a blind eagle, not a bald eagle. But he kept swooping down to the shore and going back up. And I realized in that moment that the power of God, the power of God to stop me and let me recognize that I even wanted to watch that, that something as rectangular as that was important to me, that somebody was taking me to the Tillamook Cheese Factory because I was their guest, and they wanted to be nice to me. And I learned something from this kid. He was my roommate during the weekend. He was one of the 10-minute speakers at one of the meetings, and he said something that really, really touched me. And I'll just repeat what happened. I'm just sharing my experience. This is how it happened for me. He said when he prays in the morning, he starts his prayer by saying, my dear friend. I like that. I want to have a God that's my dear friend. I do have a God that's my dear friend, and I didn't come here for that. I came here to relieve myself of that merciless obsession of alcohol so I don't have to sit outside of Ralph's on a Saturday afternoon and suck on a bottle of tequila. I don't want to have to live like that anymore. I don't want to have to live it like that anymore, and I hope I remember. So I'm going to tell you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And the only reason we bother to do any drunk log, if you're new, is I do drunk log because if I don't have your problem, I can't have your solution. So hopefully I'll tell you some of the bizarre, ridiculous things I did under the lash of alcoholism. You could say, yep, that's me too. And if that's the case, and you live the way that I lived, I don't live like that anymore. I don't live like that anymore because I run with you. You are my tribe. You are my people. Much to my chagrin. I'm kidding. Alcoholics Anonymous are the greatest people in the world. Greatest people in the world. I didn't always feel that way. You know, I don't want to have to sit out. There's an Imperial Alano Club in Paramount, California. They call it the Snake Pit. They have meetings there all week, like three times a day. I want to tell you, if you ever see that in a directory, the only good meetings are Tuesday night and Sunday night. The rest are just spreading a disease, in my opinion. Right? Sorry. I have an opinion. Oh, shock, you know. But I sat outside that Alano Club in like 85 or 86 with about this much in a pint of Jim Beam stuck in the back of my pocket. And I was sitting on the gas meter and there was a meeting inside sobbing, that sick, pitiful, sobbing alcoholic going, I wish I was an alcoholic. If I was an alcoholic, I would be in there. But I'm not. I'm not an alcoholic. You know, I'm drinking a quart of whiskey every day, but it's just maintenance, man. I'm misunderstood. I'm the victim of the worst luck in history, you know. I just have a problem with geography and timing and women and jobs. You know, I'm just bad luck. You know, I might be the most unlucky man you've ever met in your life. You know, but I'll tell you in general what it used to be like. You know, I come from a good family. My mother was a practicing alcoholic. My father was a practicing alcoholic. But my mom raised five kids. She raised a hospital administrator who got a couple of degrees so she could help run a hospital. My next sister down was a nun. Yeah, nun. Then there was me. My sister under that works with seriously emotionally disturbed, physically challenged kids. I don't know if handicapped is the word, but these are very, very sick children. And, you know, like if you teach them to recognize their mother and father, or maybe say, Ma, in a semester, that's a good semester. And my little brother was a priest. Yeah. I stuck out in a family picture, I promise you that. You know, which one of them is the black sheep? I think it's me. But I always felt uncomfortable. You know, I've heard it said many times. If you're sitting here, you might relate. I felt uncomfortable my whole life, as long as I can remember. One of the first meetings I ever went to, first time I ever related to somebody, he said when he was a little kid, he saved all his money for reflectors. And he put them out in the backyard to signal the mothership as a little kid. And I thought, yeah, baby, I'm with you, man. I'm with you. Sign me up. You know, because I just felt it. I just felt separated from, and my skin didn't fit right, and I was terrified all the time. I'm in the fourth grade. This has nothing to do with drinking, but it has everything to do with alcoholism. I'm in the fourth grade, and my mother's raising five kids on state aid. So she's giving me what I thought are inferior lunches. She's making peanut butter sandwiches and a couple of Ritz crackers and a nickel for milk. It's just the best she could do. But I didn't see this at the time. And I couldn't risk. It looked to me like all of you had a 12-inch Subway sandwich and a big bag of Doritos and a 2-liter bottle of Dr. Pepper and a box of Twinkies. That's what it looked like to me, you know. And I couldn't risk taking my lunch out and eating it in front of you and risk you looking at me and confirming my suspicions that I was a piece of shit. Who said that? The birthday guy. Randy. I suffered from piece of shitism, you know. That's the last time I'm going to swear from the podium. If my wife hears this tape, it is not going to be a happy day in the cookhouse, you know. But rather than risk taking my lunch out and having you confirm my suspicions by a glance, or God forbid you say anything, because then we have to fight, I would take my lunches and I would stuff them in my desk. I would rather go hungry. I would rather die of alcoholism than look bad, but I would stuff them in my desk. And after a couple of months of this, I don't know anything about time and temperature violations, you know. And Sister Mary beat me. I mean, Sister Wilhelmina is circling the class, and she's trying to find out where this smell has come from, you know. Well, she finds it in my desk, and she starts pulling out these green moldy lunches. And I said the mold was a penicillin experiment. I'm talking, you know. But I realized she handled it very badly, you know, only in hindsight. And I didn't know any better in 1957, 58. God, I'm old. But she didn't handle it very well. She didn't handle it very well. And she asked me for the first time that I can remember that question I was going to be asked 100,000 times, and it was the same answer. Sister looked at me and she said, "What's wrong with you?" And I wanted to say, "Well, sister, I need a martini," you know. Right. But I didn't. I told her what I always told you. I told you what I always told the police, what I always told my wife, what I told my company commander, what I told the doctors and the psychiatrists, what I told my children, what I told my ex-wives. I told them, I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with me. And thank God. Thank God tonight I know what's wrong with me. I'm an alcoholic. I suffer from the disease of alcoholism. And that's multi-tentacled. For if you're new, sadly, it has nothing to do with not drinking. You know, if you stop drinking, the problem's coming. You know, then you'll get in touch with alcoholism. You know, I have a mental obsession that says I have to drink. And I have a physicalology that says when I take a drink, look out. I just drink until I can't drink anymore. But I didn't have a drink in the fourth grade. I would have been offered, had I been offered one. But in like 19, maybe I was in the fifth or sixth grade, my mother's a practicing alcoholic, and I went to a christening, and they were drinking screwdrivers. And at 11 years old, maybe, I asked my mom, could I have one of those? And she said yes. That's a dysfunctional family. If my 11-year-old daughter asked me for a highball, I'm telling her no. You know, simple as that. No, honey, you can't slam any heroin after lunch either, you know. But I'm not going to let her do that. But she said, okay, and I had a couple of those. And I'm this kid that's terrified. I told you that I'm ill at ease. I needed a drink badly. And I'm the kind of kid that goes to a party and just sits on my hands because it's going to be bad. I'm going to do something to get in trouble. I don't mean to get in trouble. Trouble just seems to hang out with me a lot. I was at my granny's. The one time I was at her house, somebody had a BB gun. And they let me hold it for a minute. And a sparrow flew by at about 40 yards. And I shot. I got it. I shot a sparrow with a BB gun. You know, I'm not Annie Oakley. I'd never fired any kind of weapon in my life. But I caught heck for that. I got a beating for shooting that sparrow. Anyway, so I'm the kind of kid that sits on my hands. But at that christening, they gave me a couple of screwdrivers. And I drank them down, and I was set free for the first time. And I decided it was a good idea. I asked my family if they'd all come into the living room. All my relatives are there for the christening. And I wanted to do the Johnny Mathis show for them. Chances are. After about three or four songs, they just put little Mickey to bed. You know. Crazy. Alcohol does something really unusual to me. You know, and I didn't have any luck. I didn't get drunk every day after that. I would have. Because it did something for me. Alcoholism gave me the ability to go, oh, my God. For the first time in my life, I was free. Same year, I broke my hand on Joe Canzoni's head. Not because I'm a tough guy, because I'm afraid. And I have to defend my position. I broke my hand, and they gave me Demerol. Yeah, every time I tell that story, I get a hum of recognition. So you've met my little friend Demerol. But so that morning, they're getting ready to set my hand, and they gave me Demerol. And I'm struggling. I'm not one of these people that was an overachiever. I did not decide that I would get straight A's because I wasn't feeling bad. I gave up by the time I was in the fourth grade. I was pretty much going to amount to nothing, and up until tonight, so far, so good. But they gave me Demerol. And my mom, who was a practicing alcoholic, she was trying to get me to do stuff like a normal kid, to get decent grades, and she'd reward me for it. And she'd give me a quarter for an A, a dime for a B, and a nickel for a C. I was getting occasional nickel, you know. But when they gave me that Demerol, I told my mom, I said, Mom, I don't know what they just gave me, but I can get straight A's from now on. I said, just get me some more of that. She played this back to me. I went on and I said, Mom, get it to me for Christmas. Give it to me for my birthday. Put it in my stocking, you know, in my Easter basket. I love Demerol. Not so much because I love the drug. I love the effect. I love not feeling the way I feel on the natch, as they say. I don't like the feeling when you take Demerol away. I don't like the feeling when you take alcohol away. You took alcohol away and you told me there's a process here that has to create some kind of psychic change so I don't have to run anybody off the road tonight on the way back to Downey. Because he left his turn signal on for a mile and a half. You should kill him. Right? Some days. Right? Now I'm getting deaf, so I do that all the time. So I've got to stop giving up on that. But I'm not having any luck. I'm not having any luck. When I'm 17, you know, I'm the kind of kid, my family's coming out of church, and I'm 12 years old, and I'm handcuffed in the back of the squad car as my saintly brothers and sisters walk by with my mom. I got caught stealing cigarettes out of some cars. I didn't even smoke. But I knew stealing was going to be a skill I was going to use a lot later, so I was working on it. But I didn't drink every day after that, but I sure wanted to. When I was 17 years old, my mother said, you can smoke in the house. I said, great. She said, but you can't live in the house. You know. Well, one for two wasn't bad. I'd been smoking in the house for a couple of months, but she smoked in the house, and nobody knew except my sisters. And they couldn't tell her because I'd kill them. You know. So I went to the United States Army. I told my mom, I think I'm going to go enlist in the service. And she said, let's go. I'll drive you. You know. And at didn't work out well for me. I mean, I've got the two of the daughters that produced grandchildren for me that lived down here in the Navy. One's been in for almost 10 years. The other one's been in for 8 years. My son just got out after 10 years, and they're good servicemen. They do a good job. That was not my experience. I didn't know. I'll tell you something. If you're young enough and you get so, I'm going to go into service. Great. Might be a good idea. It's been a great career for my kids. But I don't care how discouraged you get. You can't quit. They don't care. You got to fulfill your commitment. It's not like a sponsor that's a suggestion. Oh, no. They'll lock your ass up if you don't fulfill your commitment. So I got out of basic training, and I was really gung-ho, and I went home, and they gave me a 28-day leave, and 41 days later, they arrested me. Because I wasn't done drinking. I don't know that I have a physical allergy. I don't know this. I didn't know that till I got here. So they arrested me, and I went to Fort MacArthur, which isn't far from my home, and the company commander gave me this explanation. He said, "Do you realize that during the time of war and the Vietnam crisis is going on, if you're AWOL for more than 30 days, you can be tried for desertion, and that's punishable by death?" I didn't know that. I don't think of consequences. I'm just having another drink. So what he did, and he gave me this lecture, and I believed it. I thought, yeah, man, that's a mistake. I don't want to be that kind of guy. I'm going to straighten up, Captain. And I meant it that morning. I was going to straighten up. My friend Larry says, starting over is how a loser gets hope. How about finishing something for a change? How about keeping your commitment? You know, but I start over because it makes me feel good. So that morning he gave me a Greyhound bus ticket. He said, "You get on that Greyhound bus, you get your butt back to Salinas, and you report to your company commander on Monday morning and face the music." And I said, "Yes, sir." And I clicked my heels like I was going to Kansas or something. And I start walking back to the bus station, and I start to think. And I should never think. It's just even today, that's why I have a sponsor and a host of friends that know what kind of nut job I am. Because like I said, I'm a quantity thinker. I'm not a quality thinker. I just think a lot. It runs. It wakes up and it doesn't say, "Oh, good morning. Isn't this a beautiful day?" Doesn't it say, "Good morning. She's still here." You know, something like that. You know, it's Monday. You should quit, you know. So it doesn't work out well. It doesn't work out well. I go back. Oh, what happened is they gave me the bus ticket. I went to the bus station. I cashed it in. Here's what I thought. This makes perfect sense to me. It's Friday afternoon. I'm going to cash in this bus ticket, get about, I don't know, $30 or $35 at the time, and I'm going to go party with the fellas for just a couple more days, you know, because I'm feeling a little edgy, and I'll hitchhike back Sunday afternoon. You hitchhike in your uniform in 1967, you get a ride quick. I could have done it, except I forgot about having alcohol in that equation. So 31 days later, my sister called the cops on me. This time, they're really pissed off. There ain't no bus ticket to take to the Greyhound bus station. They took me back in a squad car, an Army squad car, with my hands handcuffed behind me for a nice little seven-hour drive. I had to leave my hands back there for a couple of days. I couldn't bring them forward. It was too painful, but... And it didn't work well. They gave me 6 months in a stockade and two-thirds of my pay, and I got out of the stockade and I went AWOL. And I got, then they captured me again. You know, it was no big chase. You know, I'm easy to capture. I'm passed out under the dining room table. There he is, you know. Right? That's my evasion tactics, you know. Maybe I'll roll over for him or something, you know. That's about the best I can do. Open one eye, let him know I'm alive, you know. And I went back, and again, they gave me 6 months and two-thirds of my pay. Now, mind you, I never got past E1. That's as low as you can get in the Army. And that ain't much money. When they take two-thirds of it away, and then they take two-thirds of that, I'm not very good at math, but that I owe them money, you know, right? And I went back in the stockade, and this time I got a year, you know. And I don't do jail very well. But I'm in the stockade, and I'm just a survivor. And one night, I'm in the stairwells, and I'm becoming a musician. I wanted to be the next Bob Dylan, and it wasn't going to happen because of alcohol and drugs. I could play a little and sing a little and write a little, but I was an alcoholic. It makes that really, really hard. But one night, I'm in the stairwell, and I'm singing with the fellas, and they're doing those old standards. "What's your name?" And I'm doing the high notes, and I'm just in. Well, that night, the news came that Martin Luther King had been killed. And I wake up the following day, and I'm in the emergency room, and I've got a cracked skull and several broken ribs. And what had happened is I'd gotten beaten just for being a redheaded white kid. And the reason I mention that is because I understand only in hindsight, and because of inventory, I know that prejudice is ignorance. They picked the wrong guy. So when you walk in tonight and you have too many earrings or your hat's on crooked, and I judge you, it's because I'm ignorant. The only judgment that I've passed tonight that I think is accurate is, why would you wear a San Diego Padres hat? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm in San Diego. Sorry. How does 35-7 sound for the last? I'm a diehard Dodger fan. My mother was buried in her Dodger jacket, as I will be. And I used to not hate the Padres until that little throw hit my pitcher in the head thing and that Quentin something, whatever his name is, maybe burn in hell. Anyway, I get sidetracked. So I didn't have any luck in the service, and I finally got out. I got an honorable discharge under medical conditions. Had they done a thorough evaluation, I could have got an honorable discharge under mental conditions, but I didn't. I had bronchial asthma, so I got out with a clean slate after all that. And I got out of the service, and I got drunk, and I got married, and I got drunk, and I got married, and I got drunk, and I got married, you know. And that's bad, and it's funny, but there was children in the wake of my alcoholism. You know, when it got to be too hard, I just abandoned ship. I'm not a follower thrower. I'm not a stick to it. I'm a runner. When it gets too hard, I just give up. I just give up. But I've gone back to those children and I've made amends. The children that I visited in San Diego are from my third marriage. My ex-wife from that marriage celebrates the holidays with us. She comes to my home at Christmas because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a very lucky man. I'm a very lucky man. Those marriages didn't work out. And I'm not having any fun. Alcoholism is having fun with me. It's telling me how I will live, where I will live, how long I'll keep a job, or how quickly I'll lose a job. It just rules me. I'm the kind of drinker. I was on the south side of Seal Beach Pier at about 9 o'clock in the morning with a buddy of mine, and he'd left a gallon of Red Mountain. I don't know how much it was left in the bottle when he left at 9 o'clock, but I know it was too much. Because I woke up about 2:30 in the afternoon, I passed out at 9 o'clock in the morning. I was wearing a fatigue jacket, an army jacket, jeans, because that was very hippie cool. I was wearing a fatigue jacket, jeans, and no shoes, and I fell asleep like this for 5.5 hours. And at 2:30, some good Samaritan walked by and decided he should cook me on the other side, because I was burnt to a crisp on half of my face, the bottoms of my feet. It was ugly. You know, it looked like a Halloween costume. I was, you know, freckle-faced on this side and bright red on this side. You know, Johns Hopkins has a series of questions. They have a series of 20 questions. If you're new and somebody says you should take these 20 questions, you should take these 20 questions. If you don't want to stay here, don't do that. It's a trick. It's a trick because you're going to fail that test. But Johns Hopkins has a series of 20 questions, and I've always thought that there should be 22 questions. Of course, my sponsor has told me do not call them. These are bad questions. But question number 21. If you've ever had a sunburn on the inside of your mouth, you're an alcoholic. I had sunburn on the inside of my mouth, and I'm not the only one. I've heard people had it on the roof of their mouth. That's bad. Question number 22. If you go to a liquor store or a bar and you haven't had a drink, and they slide your favorite alcohol or cocktail across the bar, and you feel better before you ever make contact with that, you're an alcoholic. Average temper drinker doesn't have that experience. I do. And like I said, my sponsor said, do not call Johns Hopkins. They're not going to make the pamphlet. Anyway, so I eventually got sober. That's how I drink. That's how I drink. And wait, right before I got here, I called wife number 3. I've been married 25 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to the same woman. Yeah, and I'll tell you why. We don't take any credit for that. You get all the credit. And the fact that we never wanted to get divorced on the same day. You know, if it had been unanimous in the house, we'd have got divorced. But only one of us wanted it on Wednesday. The other one wanted it on Friday, so we stayed married. You know. But just before I got sober for the first time, my ex-wife number 3, the one that celebrates the holidays with us. How am I doing on time? Oh, my goodness. I'm going to get sober here. I called her, and I'd used her up over and over and over and over again. They were staying with her grandfather or her father, and I called her, and I said, Lisa, I'm sick, and I was sick. I said, could you help me out? Could you help me out? I'd been living on the roof of a school, and it wasn't working out very good. And she said, sure, and she bought me a quart of Jack Daniels, and we got a hotel room, and I started to pull on that bottle, and I started to tell that little girl the story. I started telling her the dream. I was building that castle in the sky. I said, honey, I'm going to get the job back at the restaurant. The same restaurant that I'd worked at 7 times. You know, because I was good from Monday through, like, Wednesday. You know, one time they sent me to smoke on a Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock. I came back 2.5 years later. I'm not good at this life thing. But that, I told her that night, I said, we're going to be a family again. I'm going to save some money. We're going to get a place. We're going to get a place, and we're going to be a family. And she believed it, and I believed it. And that morning, we went downstairs, and I'm sick, and I got to go take care of being sick. And I walked across the street, and my wife and daughter walked the other way, and I made a grave mistake. I turned around, and I looked at my daughter, and I don't ever want to forget the look in her eyes. I don't ever want to forget. That tears at your soul. That's the thing that drove me in Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't being passed out at Seal Beach. It was that feeling. It was that feeling of nothingness. That feeling of lower than low. A month later, I went over to steal or borrow $20 from the same woman. I'd stolen my mother's car to get there. Her orange Ford Fiesta, the license plate said Happy One. Oh, that's a real chick magnet, I want to tell you. But I steal her car, and I go over there, and I get $20 from my ex-wife, and I'm driving down the driveway, and I look in the rearview mirror. Now two of my kids are chasing me. They're going, Daddy, don't go. They don't know if I'm going to be gone a day, a week, a month, 6 months. They just don't know. And I don't know. I'm not done till the beast says I'm done. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1982 for the very first time with my hands in the air, and I'd had my butt kicked pretty good. And I stayed here for 8.5 years, and I went back out there, and I went back out there on Vicodin. I got a prescription for 100, and it took me a couple of days. I broke 1.5. And he wrote a prescription for 100 Vicodin with 6 refills 7 times in 2.5 years. That's 4,200 pills I don't share. And I had to drink behind that. I had to drink behind that, and I had to try to learn how to slam cocaine and do the marijuana maintenance program, none of which works. If you're here tonight and you're trying to do the marijuana maintenance program, it's not going to do much for your alcoholism. You're going to eat a crap load of Doritos, but it's not going to make you feel any better. So at about 5.5 years, I'm starting to go crazy. I am losing my mind. I'm losing my mind. I'm not going to Alcoholics Anonymous. Slowly but surely, I left. And the best way I've ever heard of it is I used to go to 10 meetings a week, 7 meetings a week, 3 meetings a week, 1 meeting a week, and then a glass of wine with dinner. Or half a Vicodin. Or just a roach. Something to separate me from that sunlight, right, is going to take me back out there. And I know that for sure. So at 8.5 years, I went to this doctor, and he prescribed these Vicodin, and I wound up taking them, and it didn't work out for me. It was really, really bad. I wound up living in a treehouse. That's really fun if you're 10, you know. It's not fun if you're 40, you know. Just not. No, I wasn't 40. Yeah, 40. I mean, I'll tell you why that's not fun. I'm living in a treehouse, and I'm drinking Red Mountain wine, and I'm smoking weed out of a Hagen Haig 5-star pinch scotch bottle water pipe that I made. I'm cool, man. And I'm just about out, and one of my buddies came to see me, and I was on fire. And I don't mean on fire with the spirit or listening to Jimi Hendrix and rocking out. I had leaned into a candle, and I was on fire, you know. That's not good. That's not good. But in 1996, on February 1996, I came in, and I'd given up. What's the next sign? Is it now? Okay. So February 25th of 1996, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with my hands up. And I tell you what, when I came home from my first meeting, the lady that took me said, are you going to stay? And I said, Pat, I'm willing to do anything if I can be sober. I'm willing to be miserable if I can be sober. And it's a good thing I said that, because I wanted to get loaded every day for 18 months. So if you're new and you're struggling and you think your head still says, you've only got 10 days, go ahead. You've only got a couple of months, go ahead. You need a little relief. I want to tell you I understand, but I want to tell you you don't have to. You cannot drink here even if you want to. They say you don't have to drink if you really don't want to. No, you can stay here and not drink even if you want to. We will support you in the process. So I came here and I did what they suggested. I got a sponsor. When I first got here, I got a woman sponsor because she was tough. You know, I wanted the toughest person I could find, and I picked this lady out, Tony LaRue. She was supposed to be tough, and I went up and I said, Tony, will you sponsor me? She said, sure, honey. I remember thinking, well, she must like me because I'm a guy. She said, come here, and she walked me down to the end of the sidewalk at the YMCA. She put her finger in my chest, and she said, don't you ever lie to me, you son of a bitch. And I thought, whoa, wow. Maybe I was a little hasty. I didn't realize that sure, honey was the last nice thing she was ever going to say to me, you know. But she saved my life. She saved my life. Because for a year and a half, she made me build a good foundation. One of the things she had me do was read January 6th in a 24-hour day book. And what it says in there, and I'll paraphrase, it says, my decision not to take a drink today is the only security I'm ever going to have. It's not a different wife or a bigger house, more cars, more money, a better position in society. None of that. It's if I can make the decision not to get loaded today, I got a chance. 11:59 tonight, that's what I'm shooting for. I have a chance. The rub is, I have no chance to do that without you. I have no chance. So I got a sponsor, and he dragged me through the steps. And he dragged me through the steps, and I started to get free. I was able to forgive my mother. My mother died in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, 27 years sober, and had a great send-off. My father wasn't quite so lucky. chronic alcoholic, kind of father that abandons families like I did. And about 12 years ago, he drank a quart of black velvet, wrote the note to the kids, and apologized for being the kind of dad that I was, wrapped himself in a plastic shower curtain, went in the kitchen on a linoleum floor, and blew his brains out. I get that. That's untreated alcoholism. That's what happens to people like me if you separate me from the anesthetic alcohol or if I have to live in there too long. I gotta go. It demands treatment. It demands an end. It demands a solution. It demands a way out. For me, it does. It demands a way out. It's got to end somehow. And I came here and you dragged me through the steps and I feel differently about my life. I got cancer about 3.5 years ago. It was not a good morning. I go to the doctor and he says, little Chinese guy, he says, Mr. Cook, he says, I have bad news for you. He says, you have cancer. And then he got quiet for a minute to see if I would freak out. And I didn't. We're cool. I mean, inside, I'm blowing it. I'm a dead man. And I'm screaming. I'm hysterical on the inside. But the other side, I'm cool. Wow, cancer, huh? No kidding. Oh, you know. So everything he said after that, like a diagnosis or a prognosis or a plan, everything he said after that sounded like, because he was not louder than my head. So I get in my car, and I'm hysterical. I'm crying. I call my sponsor, and I said, Tom, I've got cancer. And I'm sad. That's bad. I'm crying, sobbing on the phone. He says, really? Talk a little bit about it. He goes, what's today? And I said, Monday. He said, are you dying today? And I said, no. He said, well, take care of today. Click. That's good sponsorship. You know, I called my best friend. He was equally as nice. After I whined to him for about two minutes, he said, what's today? Monday. He said, oh, you'll be dead by Friday. Call me then. Click. He hangs up. And I go home, and my wife, who was more like Nurse Cratchit than Florence Nightingale, she was loving that morning. She was very, very good to me. And she had to take care of me for about a year and a half because I had to go through chemo and all that stuff. And she learned how to be caring because she was put in that position, and she's a willing soldier in Alcoholics Anonymous. That following morning, I get up. I do what I always do. I say the third step prayer. And when I get to that part, I say, God, relieve me to bondage of self. By the third time I get there, I'm begging him to give me some freedom from this. Are you convinced yet that this could be a problem? Yeah, I am. It's a problem. I have it under arrest. I've got a firm grasp on it, right? So that morning, I do what I always do. I said the third step prayer. I did my shower and shave, and I sit in my chair, and I read some literature and try to get quiet. I'm not one of those people that can contemplate a single white rose and have it get quiet in there. It just doesn't happen for me. Talking to my friend Larry T. a couple of months ago, I said, what do you do about quiet time? And he would look behind him like, are you talking to me? He said, it's never quiet. He says, I try to read something to plan my day and try not to be offensive to anybody. But that morning, I read a book called God Calling. And what it said that morning, it said, breathe my name. And as with the touch from a child's hand, your fear will abide. And so I thought about that for a while. And what it means is when I live my life and it says to Bob, pause when agitated, and I say, God, please help me. Thy will be done, not mine. That breathe my name. Live in that kind of a spirit. And as with the touch from a child's hand, your fear will abide. What that meant for me is if a little kid's scared and you hold their hand, they feel better. They feel better. So I know because I've had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, not I've had a spiritual awakening because I'm so bitching in AA. I've done the work, and I continue to do the work, and I keep helping men do the work, which keeps me kind of free. I sat in that chair that morning because I've tapped into that power, and I said, God, I don't know if you've heard, I have cancer. You know, he knew. You know, I said, I don't know if I have cancer. I said, and if I have to be the guy that goes through this with any kind of dignity, I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to be that guy. I want to do that. I'm willing to be your soldier. Mary Ann King says the best thing you can do in AA is just soldier on. So I said that morning, I said, I'm willing to be your soldier. I said, but please, God. I said, please don't let me be afraid the whole time. Please. I spend so much of my time afraid. Don't let me live in fear of this the whole time. And that voice came to me and said, I am holding you in my arms. And for those that don't believe that, no explanation is sufficient. For those that believe that, no explanation is necessary. I want to tell you, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous because you carry God to me. You simply carry God to me. It says deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. You just got to clear out that crap so you can tap into that. And I'm not saying any kind of spiritual behemoth. I get it wrong more than I get it right. I go to the U.S. Open of surfing every year. I didn't even know there's water there, but there's a lot of hot girls in bikinis. You know, I'm kidding. I'm not a saint in recovery. But I tell you what, I always end my talk the same way. First again, thanks again, Damien, for having me. Thanks for being such a group. Thanks for being attentive. Thanks for not texting. Thanks for not talking. Thanks for not walking around, because I'm the guy that has to put the toys away. Because I can't focus. But I love you for what you've taught me. I love you for what you show me. I love you for what you continue to bring to me. Howard P. always says, if you find a place where you see God pass, mark that spot and visit that window often. It's right here for me. Thank you very much.